Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning, and welcome to The Show on KJZZ 91.5 FM in Phoenix. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, a decades-long effort to incorporate one Pinal County community could come to a vote later this year.
And using dogs to track endangered orchids.
But first, the end of the fiscal year is about 2 months away, but there's been little talk at the state capitol, at least publicly, about a new budget. Last week, GOP lawmakers and the governor reached a deal to fund a program for residents with developmental disabilities for the rest of this fiscal year, but there's so far no sign of agreement on a new spending plan for next year. With me, as he is every Monday during the legislative session to talk about what to expect this week at the state capitol, is Howie Fisher of Capitol Media Services. And Howie, let's go just a little while back to a meeting of a group called the Finance Advisory Committee earlier this month, basically a group of economists which meets to look at the state's fiscal picture. And that picture looks a little less good than they had forecasted earlier this year. So where do we stand and what do these numbers maybe mean for those budget talks?
Well, let's just say it's not exactly the sun is shining and the birds are chirping and the bees are buzzing kind of story. We already knew that there was going to be some fallback in terms of the amount of new revenues next year. I mean, that just sort of happens. You get to a point where you can't keep doing these 4% and 5% and 6% increases. But what's complicated it is the economy, and more to the point, you know, what Donald Trump is doing, particularly with tariffs. And they say, you know, we've got an economy in the state that is dependent on sales. Half the revenues for the state come from sales taxes. Mm-hmm. And so let's say people don't buy new cars because the new cars coming in that are maybe a Ford nameplate but manufactured in Mexico are now 25% more. The cost of even repairing your cars is going up. And so people will buy fewer cars, or they'll buy cheaper cars, or they won't be buying that new iPhone or things like that, all of which adds up to less revenues than they were anticipating. They had originally thought that next year we'd have a surplus of about $600 million out of a $17.8 billion budget. Well, after, you know, going ahead and doing the little magic incantations, you know, slaughtering a chicken and, you know, burning its bones and doing all the stuff that economists do, they say, well, we're now down below $300 million. So we've got a surplus of less than 2%, which is not exactly a good place to be. And that's after, you know, considering everything else that could happen that we don't know is going to happen. At the same time, when you have uncertainty in the economy, well, we need people who are collecting benefits. You know, are more people on the Arizona healthcare cost containment system?
Yeah.
You've got the expense side of it. So it's going to be kind of rocky. And the question now for lawmakers is, how much do they want to build in based on what may or may not happen? I mean, it was nice several years ago when every lawmaker was given $20 or $30 million and said, go out and find something to spend it on. That's not going to happen. There are, however, still people like J.D. Mesnard, who's a Chandler senator, who thinks we can reduce the state income tax rate, not by a lot. But then again, we come back to the question here of, if we have a budget that's based largely on sales taxes and we're decreasing the other main source of revenues, which is income taxes, are we making the state more dependent and more reliant and more subject to the variances in the economy?
Yeah, that's really interesting. I suspect, Howie, you and I are going to be talking about the budget a lot more, perhaps in the weeks ahead. But, you know, so you mentioned state services. There's a bill coming up this week that would link basically jobless benefits, unemployment benefits, to the unemployment rate. What's that about?
This has been an ongoing issue. Now, remember, the state does not pay unemployment benefits.
Yes.
This is insurance. This is paid by employers. The employers, however, say to the legislature, well, you know, we don't necessarily want to be responsible for all that, even if we did fire somebody for no fault of their own, or even if we did have to lay them off. And so they want to decrease the number of weeks you can get unemployment. Right now, you can get unemployment for up to 26 weeks. And the unemployment is supposed to be based on half of your salary, but with a cap of, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of $320 a week. Mm-hmm. This would cut it down as low as 12 weeks, depending on the unemployment rate. Now, at the moment, we happen to have a relatively low unemployment rate. But let's get back to that committee of economists that we were talking about earlier. They're noticing that there's been an increase in the unemployment rate. And they want to, you know, the question comes down to how long should people have to, you know, be able to get unemployment because of the fact that this is meant to be a transition. Is it harder to find new jobs? You know, that becomes a serious issue. And since you're only getting $320 a week, it's not like people are staying home for $320 a week, which is taxable in Arizona to boot. But the employers say, you know, we need some financial relief. And it's nice that they need financial relief. But what about the folks who are working with them? This is something that I have a feeling will get the legislative vote. I have a feeling it's also going to get a veto from the governor.
Interesting. Howie, there's also a bill that kind of harkens back to earlier in the school year or last year when there were encampments being set up protesting the war between Israel and Hamas in Gaza. This is a bill that would deal with those. And my understanding is it would make it much more difficult to set those encampments up on college campuses.
Exactly. Now, there are already laws in the state that limit certain things you do on campuses, as long as they're content neutral, that you're not picking on one side versus the other. The universities can establish reasonable time, place, and manner of protests. This simply says, if in fact you set up an encampment, meaning like a tent or a structure, it cannot be set up overnight, which to a certain extent makes sense, or a quote-unquote prolonged period of time, which is not defined in law. Mm. Now, there are a lot of folks who say, A, you know, you're interfering with First Amendment rights, but B, from a more practical standpoint, let's assume you're setting up one of these shade tents to go ahead and register folks to vote. How many hours would you have to be there before you're going to be accused of having a prolonged presence on the campus with a structure? It's kind of nebulous. And for example, Senator Mitzi Epstein said, look, if two people can look at the same legislation and come up with two different opinions of what it means, that's not good legislation. This should come up this particular week. I think there's a final reading on it in the Senate. I have no idea what the governor is going to do with this one. This is a little closer call, I think, for the governor, because you do have a number of Democrats, including Representative Alma Hernandez, who proposed it, who is Jewish, who was very concerned last year about ASU and U of A and Jewish students being harassed on campus. So it's more of a mixed bag on this one. It's not exactly a partisan affair the way, for example, the cuts in jobless benefits might be.
Yeah. And it sounds like this bill is beyond the point of being able to amend it to maybe put in some specificity of what a prolonged amount of time would entail.
Well, that's theoretically, you cannot further amend it. Now, there is a procedure where you can take a bill back, put it in for further changes, and then send it back out. I don't think they're going to be doing a lot of that, because what was interesting is Senator Annalise Ortiz complained about the question of prolonged not being defined. And during debate, Senator Kavanaugh from Fountain Hill said, okay, if we took out the word prolonged, just had it overnight, would you vote for the bill? And she wouldn't answer. So some of these objections are more philosophical.
Interesting. All right. That is Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. Howie, thank you as always.
You're welcome.
A new investigation by 404 Media has revealed that law enforcement officials in Pinal County are using AI bots as part of a strategy to identify criminals online. 404's Jason Kebler was part of the team that uncovered this, and he joins us now. Jason, good morning.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for coming on. So, Jason, it's the Pinal County Sheriff's Office that's using this program. Tell us how it supposedly works.
Yeah, so Massive Blue is a company that has been pitching its technology to different counties in Arizona. It pitched this to Yuma County, Cochise County, and Pinal County, which has a $360,000 year-long contract to try this program called Overwatch. And basically what it does is it allows cops to create these AI personas that can then talk to potential suspects. One example of an AI persona is someone named Jason, not me. It's a and then it has a backstory. This is an example of the type of persona that they're creating. And so Jason is 14 years old. He's from Los Angeles. His parents immigrated from Ecuador. He's an only child. He likes anime, gaming, comic books. And basically, this AI bot's job is to talk to potential child traffickers to collect evidence about them.
Got it. And so how do these bots notionally do this? Do they just go on various social media sites and try to kind of lure in would-be evildoers?
That's what, sure what it seems like. We reported this story by filing a lot of public records requests, and there were emails between the company Massive Blue and the Pinellas Sheriff's County asking for different keywords that they wanted tracked. And so basically, it sounds like, based on the presentations we received, that these bots will monitor, say, Reddit, Snapchat, X, Instagram. And when one of these trigger words is detected, that bot will engage with them, whether that's commenting or direct messaging. And then, very interestingly, they have the ability to change platforms. So, say a conversation starts on Instagram, they might then try to move it over to a text message, for example.
I see. Okay. Well, one of the ideas here is that law enforcement might be able to use these bots to identify quote unquote protesters, which, as someone you spoke to from the Electronic Frontiers Foundation pointed out, that raises some privacy concerns. Tell us about those concerns.
Yeah, so it's really interesting because they have different types of people that these protest personas or these different personas, and they include traffickers, escorts, money launderers, drug dealers. But then, as you mentioned, it includes quote college protesters and quote external recruiters for protests. And an example of one of those personas is a woman named Heidi. Again, this is a fake bot. But her backstory is 36 years old from Texas. She's divorced, has no children, and she's very into body positivity, activism, and baking. And like you said, I spoke to civil liberties experts and said, protests are First Amendment protected activities. This is way different from trying to speak to a potential child trafficker. And we've seen this current presidential administration try to crack down on college protesters, and using the fact that someone may have participated in a protest as the pretext to revoke their visa status.
So, can I ask you, Jason? You mentioned Jason, the persona who is a 14-year-old boy who I guess would be used to try to ensnare a would-be child abuser. And you looked at a proposal where there was some sample text that Jason, this imaginary character, might put out into the internet. What did you make of the way these bots talk?
Yeah, I mean, it really had the feel of a cop walking up to a group of children and saying, "Hello, fellow kids." I mean,
Oh,
the AI generated text feels like extremely stereotypical. A lot of them are like misspelling, and there's this text where the kid says, "My mom's at work and my dad's out of town," and he's just like adding Z's to the end of moms and dads, and it's just really like it's kind of hard to believe that a human being would talk this way. But I think that in the context of social media, where there's a mix of human beings, bots, trolls, you sort of don't know who is doing what, I could imagine people being tricked by this. And that's one thing if it is, again, a potential child trafficker. It's a totally different thing if it's someone who wants to join a protest, for example.
right. Well, so speaking of people being tricked, let's talk about the effectiveness or perhaps lack thereof of this program so far. As you mentioned, Pinal County has signed a $360,000 contract with Massive Blue to use this technology. What have we seen so far? Has it led to any arrests?
Yeah, so it's led to zero arrests so far. Pinal County has said that they have active investigations that are using this software. They've declined to say what those investigations are about or how many they have. But we know that they've been using it for about a year now, and it's led to zero arrests. Both the company and the sheriff's department have been really secretive about this technology and what it does. Again, the way that we got these records is through public records requests, both with sheriff's counties in Arizona, but also in Texas, where they have a little bit more, frankly, transparent public records laws. And so I wasn't able to get these presentations directly from Pinal County. I had to get them from the Texas Department of Public Safety. And so, sort of like at county council meetings and things like that, both representatives for the company and representatives for the sheriff's department have said that they, quote, can't get into great detail about what the technology is, how effective it is, and how it works.
All right. Well, we'll have to leave it there for today, but it'll be interesting to see where this story goes. That is 404 Media's Jason Kebler joining us. Jason, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, why one in every four freshwater animals is in danger of going extinct, and what researchers are doing to prevent loss in North America.
But first, Arizona could soon have another city. Residents of Santan Valley in Pinal County have collected enough signatures to put the question of whether or not the community should incorporate on the ballot. The county recorder's office has verified those signatures, and now there's a window for potential challenges to them. Assuming the effort survives any challenges, the Pinal County Board of Supervisors will call for an election in early August. This is not the first effort for Santan Valley Incorporation, but it is the first time it'll make it as far as the ballot if it does. With me to talk more about this is Tyler Hudgens, chairman of the Santan Valley Incorporation effort. And Tyler, why should Santan Valley become its own city?
Yeah, Santan Valley has been overlooked for a number of years, and incorporation is an important path forward for us. We're tired of being a bunch of zip codes, being a bunch of homes, but we want to be a community. We want to be a place where we can gather together. So many people don't know each other just because of the nature of the way the community is set up, and we believe that incorporation is the way to move that forward. We want to be able to have proper representation. So as the old saying goes, no taxation without representation. And so we have one supervisor who represents us at the county level. Instead of that, we want to have seven representatives who live in our neighborhood, who know our community. The county's the size of Connecticut. That's a massive area, and you have elected officials who we have no accountability to them. We can't vote to change their leadership in our community because they don't live here and they're not our representatives. And so we want people who are in our community.
I want to ask you about the gathering and sort of knowing your neighbors aspect of it. What would incorporation do that you kind of can't do now? Because it seems like that's something that would be able to happen even if you're unincorporated.
Yeah, we're a patchwork of homes. And so to be able to have economic development, to start to develop commercial centers that can draw people together and create a sense of community, having community-sponsored events to bring everyone together, those sort of things that we can do through having a municipal government that can localize our community.
What have you heard from folks as you were out collecting signatures and talking to people about this? Like, what is the sort of the conversation about this?
Yeah, that's actually been the most encouraging part of all this, getting out and talking to people in our community. People are excited for this. They want this. And the reason for that is people innately feel the complex issues that are facing Santan Valley. They know what it's like to drive on these roads, having only a couple arteries in and out of Santan Valley, trying to go to work. Most people are commuting outside of Santan Valley to work all at the same time. So there's stress and anger on the roadways. There's car accidents. There's all kinds of things like that. Public safety, because our roadways, fire department can't get to where they're going. They have to go a longer route. They know what it's like to not have restaurants to be able to go and dine with their family. They know what it's like not to have parks and those kinds of things. And then just the lack of cohesion in our community. And so we don't have like a overarching master plan or something that's pushing things forward. And so things are disjointed. We have 20 car washes on every corner and dental offices and storage units. People are tired of those things. They want to attract other things to make this more of a community.
So do you think then that incorporation would lead to those other amenities, things like restaurants and shops that you want and, you know, parks and libraries and things?
Absolutely. It's as simple as looking at all the communities around us and looking at what they've been able to do because they have a local government that can attract those sort of things and develop those sort of amenities. And so we believe that this would be the pathway forward to provide those things for our community.
I want to ask you about any concerns you might have about adding another layer of government and potentially another layer of taxes to pay for some of those amenities. Is that something that you worry about or something that any of your neighbors are worried about?
Yeah, I'm a very conservative guy, and I understand that on the federal level, we're being worried about more government and those sort of things. But we're talking about the lowest level of government closest to the people. We're talking about people who handle our trash, who handle our roads, who handle our public safety, things that are extremely important for our everyday impact of our lives. And so I think government closest to the people works the best and the most efficiently. And so I think having that is, in my view, not a concern. And then also taxes. I think unincorporated is the most inefficient and wasteful use of taxpayer money. We, every year, estimate that goes in the Arizona State Shared Revenue Fund, $51.3 million to probably about $70 million, somewhere in there, that's going to fund other cities in the county, and it's not necessarily coming back to Santan Valley. So that's tens of millions of dollars every single year that are going elsewhere. And so we want those dollars to stay in Santan Valley, to fund our roads, to fund our neighborhoods, to fund the things that Santan Valley residents want, instead of paying for everyone else to be able to enjoy that.
Hmm. So this is an effort that has been going on for at least a couple of decades now to incorporate Santan Valley. Why are you optimistic that this one will succeed where all of the others have not?
Yeah, this has been going on for a long time. And, you know, I think what's different about this is the roads have been cleared, if I could say that, is there were some laws in place that prevented Santan Valley from being able to move forward. For instance, communities within 6 miles of an incorporating community all had the power to veto that. And that's happened. And that's happened based on what we just talked about, the tax issue, because the cities know that they will lose tax money that is Santan Valley residents money if we incorporate. And so in the past, we got vetoed for that. And there was a bunch of things. And I think what's also been great about this effort is the team that we've assembled. We're not in this for ourselves. We need to be in this for the community. It's the right thing to do. And I think that's the conviction that I feel more than anything. This is the right thing to do. Our community deserves this. I'm just excited for Santan Valley to have a better future, to be able to really take ownership of this community for ourselves. Pinal County, it was never set up to manage a city of over 100,000 people. And if incorporation fails, the complex issues that we face will continue to get worse. And I don't think incorporation, like if we don't incorporate, I think Pinal County, they're going to have to raise costs. They're going to have to raise taxes to be able to pay and be able to sustain this community. We're at 100,000 people. We're going to grow to 200, 300,000. These issues are going to get worse unless they get addressed. And the county is just not set up to do that. And we believe a municipal government is the best way to do it.
Just to be clear, though, is it safe to say that you don't see incorporation and setting up a city government as sort of a panacea for everything? Because you don't have to look too far to see city governments that don't function maybe as well as they could.
Yeah, no, there's definitely that case. But I think when we look at a lot of the municipalities around us, there's a good culture, a good example of how these communities have been able to develop the community and the cohesion they have between each other. And so I have faith in the voters to be able to hold their representatives accountable, to be able to advocate for their needs. I think that's harder when you have to go all the way to Florence to be able to do that, and you only have one representative who represents you, and you can't hold the other four representatives accountable. I would much rather see that we have direct access to seven people who live in our community and know our community.
All right. That is Tyler Hudgens, the chairman of the Santan Valley Incorporation Committee. Tyler, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
Steve Blackwell is the Conservation Collections Manager at Desert Botanical Garden. Among other things, his job is to try and rescue endangered plants. The work is never trivial, but recently, Blackwell and his team found themselves stumped by a particularly delicate orchid, the Spiranthes delitescens, better known by its common name, the Canelo Hills Lady's Tresses. Blackwell brought one of these into the studio last week, and he told me about the innovative approach he's taken to rescue this flower from extinction.
The flowers actually make this spiral as they flower, and that's how they get the genus name. And then the flowers themselves are just white, and they're beautiful, and they have this little lacy bottom part of it as well. So they're relatively small. They're not like your normal showy orchids, but, you know, if you look at them real close, you can see that it also has the same features as, you know, as other orchids.
And you have this one here in the studio, and it is flowering, yes. And that's a big deal.
It is a big deal because this is the first year that we've ever gotten these to flower in culture.
Since
2020.
Since 2020. Okay, yes. So 5 years.
Yes, so 5 years. And so we've, you know, just through trial and error, have finally gotten it to where we can produce these pretty quickly now.
So that means just for the layperson, yes. Like you're growing it in a lab environment rather than
exactly.
In the wild.
Yes, we're growing them in a lab environment because orchids are kind of a unique group of plants in that they actually need a specific fungus for their seeds to germinate. So the fungus, you know, in nature provides it with nutrients, and we just do the same thing. We replicate that in the lab.
Got it. It's a fungus that is naturally occurring in the environment where the orchid normally grows?
Yes, exactly.
And tell us about that environment, because it's a sort of a unique environment, particularly in Arizona, right?
Yes, Cienega. So Cienega wetlands are unique to the southwest U.S. and northern Mexico. And so they're essentially just marshlands that are saturated, and they're spring-fed. And so it's one of the most threatened habitats also because of the groundwater pumping and development and things like that.
And this particular orchid, the Canelo Hills Lady's Tresses, is endangered, correct?
It is. It's federally listed as endangered.
So this would already be a remarkable story, given the fact that this is an endangered plant. Yes. And through all of this extensive effort, you have successfully created the conditions in the lab to grow them, get them to flower. But there's another layer to this story, which is that they're very difficult to find in the wild, right?
They are. So as you can see, this plant, it's about 20 inches tall, but the habitat that grows in really dense vegetation, typically grasses, and those are about 2 feet tall. So when you're walking through it goes up to your knees, and it's really difficult to find, and it's a white inflorescence, so it blends in really well with the rest of the vegetation.
So you need to find them in the wild so that you can harvest seeds from them, right?
Well, part of it is that, but also we want to assess the population size and see how they're doing, mm-hmm. and just to get an overall idea of how many plants are in this general area. And as of now, there are only 2 populations left of it in the wild.
Only 2.
Where in historically, there used to be 5.
So to address this challenge of how difficult they are to find in the wild, you guys have been using an innovative resource.
We have. So we've been working with a company called Canine Incentive, and Laura Lee Oliver is the owner of that. And her company is focused on ecological scent detection, and she uses trained dogs to do that. And so she's been training dogs for years to find things like endangered rodents, turtles, snakes, and things like that. But she hadn't worked with an orchid before. So when I approached her, I asked her if she wanted to work with an orchid, and she jumped at it. And so we've been using two of her dogs is Muon and Cersei, and you know, they're incredible what they do out there.
I saw some video of Muon and Cersei. One of them is like a black lab, it looks like.
Yes, one's a black lab, and the other one is a Belgian Malinois mix.
Okay. And how quickly were they able to find the Lady's Tresses orchids as compared to you or other members of your team out there in the wetlands looking?
That's a great question. So let me just rewind a little bit. So in order to train the dogs, because there are so few of this species left in the wild, what we actually had to do was use another species in the same genus that we collected from Nevada. There's thousands of those plants out in the wild, because we needed something for the dogs to train on. So what we did is we took some of those plants to the training facility, and we wanted to see if they could distinguish this species, this orchid, amongst other types of plants. And then the tricky part was going to be, okay, does this plant smell similar enough to the our target species that we're trying to get in the wild?
Right.
And so we were hopeful of that. They were successful at training on the other species.
The Nevada species
at the facility. And then so when we first took them down into the wild, we wanted to see, okay, first of all, they're working in a very different habitat. They're working in, you know, these wild conditions, this dense vegetation. And so at first we were concerned. We weren't sure if they'd be able to find them. And, you know, I mean, they had a lot of things working against them, but as amazing as dogs are, you know, we went out there and within 15 minutes they had found the first plant.
15 minutes?
Yes. And so it was almost – it was incredible to see them. And the funny thing is, too, is when we went out there, it wasn't in flower. The leaves were just emerging from the soil, so maybe 2-inch long leaves. And we actually had to get down on our hands and knees to see what they were pointing at. And so we were So we finally got down there. We're like, yep, there's orchid leaves right there, you know, because we have all this other vegetation. And a lot of times, you know, it looks very similar, but when you get close to it, you can tell the difference between the orchids.
That must have been an extraordinary moment, in particular knowing that the plant is endangered.
Yes, it was incredible to when it first happened. And we, because it was just so unexpected, we weren't, you know, expecting them to find them that quickly. And so, and then once they were able to do that, then they found, you know, quite a few other ones throughout the population, and that was pretty exciting as well. But the very first time that they did it, we were all pretty excited about it.
What do you feel like this experience has taught you, if anything? Do you feel like there are learnings here that you can apply to other endangered species in your purview?
Well, definitely. Well, like I said, this is the first orchid I've ever worked with, but we also have 25 other species in Arizona.
And of orchids?
Of orchids, yes. And a lot of those are rare as well. So what this does is opens up our ability to actually grow more of these species. And that's what we would like to do, is have at least maybe some representation of the plants themselves, these different orchid species, not only in plant form, but also in seed, in our seed bank.
Last question for you. You mentioned this was the first orchid you had worked with.
Yes.
Do you feel like, I mean, obviously you're a plant lover, somebody who cares about plants
Absolutely.
Very deeply.
Yes.
Do you feel like your relationship to orchids changed as a result of this process?
That's a great question, because people always ask me, it's like, what is your favorite plant, you know? And I always tell them, oh, it's, you know, it's whatever plant I'm working on at the moment. Uh-huh. And it's no different with this one. So at the moment, this is my favorite species to work on. I love it. I think it's a beautiful plant, and I hope that, you know, it flowers in time for people to see it at the garden.
All right. Well, Steve Blackwell is Conservation Collections Manager at the Desert Botanical Garden. And we thank him and his Canelo Hills Ladies Tresses for coming into the studio today.
Thanks so much.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. As President Trump moves towards his 100th day in office, the impact of his policies and posturing has radically altered the trajectory of both domestic and international politics. Joining me now via Skype with the latest is the BBC's Rob Hugh Jones. And Rob, let's start in Canada, where there is a snap election happening today that looks like it's going to go a bit differently than many were expecting, right?
Everybody, all analysts, thought that Canada was simply going to hold an election and the Conservatives would easily win it, and after 10 years of liberal rule and so on under Mr. Trudeau. Well, actually, then what happened was Mr. Trump came to the White House and imposed things like tariffs, but also talked to Canada about Canada's becoming the 51st state. And as you know, that upset quite a few Canadians. We started hearing the American national anthem being booed, for example, on sporting occasions. I've seen pictures of Canadians waving their ice hockey sticks in the air with Canadian flags on the top. So it brought this kind of patriotism to America's nearest neighbor to the north. And of course, very, very strong relations between the two countries, trading relations in particular. But that was that caused something of a rupture. And what it also caused was a big surge in support for Mark Carney. He was the guy who had been the head of the Bank of England during the Brexit crisis, and also the head of the Canadian Central Bank during the recession 2009-2010. And so he has quite a strong resume, but not much experience, in fact, no experience of public office. But he is a very well-known figure in Canada, and he has been surging ahead. So we're now in an election where he could now win, and that's a remarkable turnaround in just a few short months. And almost any analyst of that situation would say this has all to do with Mr. Trump and what he has proposed and the relations between the U.S. and Canada. So very interesting election. We should know the results tomorrow.
Well, Rob, speaking of President Trump's impact, this week, of course, marks his first 100 days in office here in America. And we've already seen a flood of stories domestically about how his policies are impacting Americans. But what's the international point of view on his term thus far?
It's whatever you think about President Trump, you can't deny that there's been an unprecedented global tariff war. He has slashed U.S. foreign aid, for example. He has disparaged NATO allies and embraced Russia's narrative about its invasion of Ukraine. He's also spoken about annexing Greenland, retaking the Panama Canal, and, as mentioned, making Canada the 51st state. So you can see that a lot of what Mr. Trump has been saying and doing has been about things outside of America. So, of course, there's been a reaction all around the globe. I should say that his meeting of President Zelensky at the funeral of Pope Francis in the past couple of days, and the talk about some kind of a peace being brokered between Ukraine and Russia and a U.S. Involvement in that. Well, he's faced a lot of criticism about taking on board the narrative of the Russians and giving the Russians what they want. And some experts have talked about capitulating to the Russians. But at the same time, you can't deny that he has shaken things up and he has brought those two sides closer together. And we see, and just in the last couple of hours, that President Putin has called a three-day ceasefire to come into effect within about a week or so. And that is an interesting development. I'm not sure we would have necessarily got that without Mr. Trump. So things are moving in that area. But of course, he faces quite a lot of criticism outside of the U.S. Indeed, Dennis Ross, who is an American Middle East negotiator, very famous one, he's done that job for both Democratic and Republican administrations. He says what we're seeing is a huge disruption in world affairs generally. No one is certain at this point, he says, what to make of what's happening or what will come next.
Well, finally, Rob, a bit of a developing story here. There is a massive power outage in Spain at this hour with some very serious implications. Tell us what you know so far.
That's right. So in the last couple of hours, millions of people in Spain and Portugal, which is the country right next door, are facing disruption because of a massive power cut across the Iberian Peninsula. So the outage has severely disrupted transport. The Spanish authorities say the whole train network in Spain is down. Metro services and airports have also been affected, as have traffic lights, for example, communication systems. Hospitals have had to rely on emergency generators. Spain's power network says services are beginning to recover slowly, but they reckon it will take at least 6 hours to fully restore power. I should say it's not known what caused the problem. Spain's Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez is meeting with his National Security Council, and the power cuts really focused on Spain and Portugal, but they've also briefly affected parts of southwestern France as well. So that's a major power story in Europe developing right now, and we'll see where it goes. But that has had a quite extraordinary effect across, you know, what is a very developed part of the world, Spain, Portugal, and southwestern France.
Power dynamics, both literal and figurative, this morning. That is the BBC's Rob Hugh-Jones, keeping us in the loop as always. Rob, thank you so much.
Great. Thanks so much.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. A quarter of freshwater animals around the world are at risk of extinction. That's the finding of a new report published in the journal Nature. And while many of those species are found in places like Africa, South America, and Asia, there are those in North America as well, including in Arizona. Ian Harrison is co-chair of the Freshwater Conservation Committee for the Species Survival Commission. He's also assistant director of the Free Flowing Rivers Lab at Northern Arizona University and worked on this paper. He joins me to talk more about what he and his colleagues found. And Ian, let's start with the headline here that one out of every four freshwater animals are at risk of extinction. How concerned and surprised are you by this?
Well, I mean, it's very concerning. Definitely, that's a very significant portion of freshwater species that are threatened. I mean, to some extent, not surprising because we've known for a long time that freshwater species are highly threatened, but to have some reliable statistic on the extent is good to know. And more importantly, that we actually have this kind of spatially mapped so that we can see where globally where the threats are greatest.
Do the places where the threats are the greatest correspond to the places where some of the reasons for this data are coming from? Like, does that match up where, like, problem and impact?
Well, yes. So, I mean, the areas that are heavily where you see greatest numbers of species threatened are ones, to a large extent, where you'd expect that, whether it's because of habitat loss or overfishing or pollution. So Lake Victoria is in Africa is heavily threatened. That's a kind of a fishing issue. Parts of India are heavily threatened because of, and that's more a habitat loss issue. So the areas where you see the large numbers of species threatened are certainly where, you know, we know that there are threats.
What would the impact be of these species actually going extinct, even if not fully, you know, a quarter of all of them? Let's say some percentage of these species that are threatened go extinct. Like, what's the impact there?
Well, I mean, from my perspective, obviously, the first thing is it's kind of an aesthetic loss in that, I personally feel that the world is a richer place with the species in it, and so anything that's gone and gone forever is as I see it is tragic. But there are some very practical reasons. Not that that's not practical, but there are other very practical reasons for being concerned in that a loss of a species can affect the ecology of an ecosystem, which can then affect other species. It can create an imbalance in the kind of the food webs, and we've seen that in some lakes where species have been fished out, and you get proliferation of other species. So it causes an ecological disturbance, but also a lot of these species have an important value to us. You know, obviously fishes, some of them are important for fisheries and for subsistence fisheries and for sort of indigenous subsistence fisheries in particular. But there are many other values from freshwater species beyond food. Plants are used in many parts of the world for thatching, for building huts and things like that. So there's this sort of inherent loss of the ecosystem services they provide.
You mentioned a couple of the places where there are a good number of threatened species. Arizona is not really one of those, although it seems as though you did take a look at a part of the Grand Canyon. And I'm curious what lessons you take from that area and maybe the species in that freshwater body up there that maybe can teach us something about other places as well.
Yes, well, I mean, the Grand Canyon is interesting because, yeah, although it's relatively low on numbers of species that are only found there, it means that that the threats proportionally the species that are under threat are really important because there aren't many species, but they're all heavily threatened. So that's a significant impact on the ecosystem. And I mean, in the case of the Grand Canyon, then we're looking at that issues are caused by river fragmentation, by dams, which, you know, changing the flows and changing the nature of the water in terms of temperature and things like that. And obviously that's a global issue. I mean, there are the issue of dams and fragmentation is global. But the interesting interesting thing about the Colorado is that, you know, there are lessons learned from that. There have been great studies from the Global Center, the Grand Canyon Monitoring Center of USGS here, looking at how the changes in flows that affect the macroinvertebrates and where they're laying eggs along the rocks. That's affected by the water releases, which reduces invertebrate populations, which then has a knock-on effect because there are, you know, birds that live in the canyons that are reliant on those populations. And so bird numbers are, you know, can decline because of that. So it's actually taught us something about the kind of the nuances of the ecology of these areas, that how one species being impacted can affect many others.
Yeah, that is interesting. So when you look at the places where these species are threatened, is there time to reverse it, or has the ship kind of sailed on this, do you think?
There is time to reverse it. I mean, I think we have a very significant challenge ahead of us. That's for sure. But there is certainly time to reverse it. And I think that's something that this paper is showing, is it's pointing us to where the most important areas are, where we know that there are either the most species that are threatened, or where, say, there are high numbers of endemic species which are found nowhere else. So, you know, really important to try and conserve them. And it's pointing us to where we can most urgently do work. And you know, there are solutions in terms about how we think about our water management and so, you know, how we try and look at, you know, if we're going to do development, you know, where can we do that that's going to be least impactful on ecosystems rather than the most impactful? So definitely there are solutions, challenging ones, but they're there.
Do you find that these tend to be the kinds of solutions that we generally hear about when climate change and that kind of thing comes up? Or is this sort of a separate set of maybe changes that we have to make?
I think it's both. I mean, a lot of them are climate related. I mean, then they're becoming more so in terms about how we think about how we're using our water. As I say, if we're thinking about development, then we need to think about what that means in terms of where we're getting our water from and how that impacts the rivers or the lakes or the underground aquifers that we're taking the water from. I mean, there are other things that aren't climate related, issues of pollution, for example. Things like that are issues that we can address, which really aren't climate related, but very important. I mean, similarly, the way we use our land, our habitat modification, we can look at that, and particularly, you know, how we're managing riparian areas, the forested areas, the vegetation around rivers, which is really important for them in terms of reducing sediment input and providing shade and that kind of thing.
Ian Harrison is Assistant Director of the Free Flowing Rivers Lab at NAU and co-chair of the Freshwater Conservation Committee for the Species Survival Commission. And that'll do it for this Monday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for being along. For Sam Dingman, I'm Mark Brody here in Phoenix. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow. That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.